From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Saratoga.
Presidio.
San Francisco, California. Excelsior District, District 11.
Montaloma School District, Mountain View, California.
Coming up, we delve into one architect's process of designing sacred spaces.
When you're praying, you're seeing the face of the other, and that the divine dwells in that holy space where humans connect.
Then we meet a Hiroshima survivor whose Buddhist practice helps her deal with the past.
And life is like the river that flows every day. It changes constantly.
And we learn the story behind this week's audiograph mystery sound. Places of Healing, today on Cross Currents. Architecture has the power to transform. A building can make us feel joy or sadness. It can make us feel powerful or weak. And for some people, that happens when they walk into a church, a chapel, a synagogue, a Buddhist temple, or a mosque. For centuries, religion has sparked the design of some of the world's most beautiful buildings. But what is that process? What built elements make a space sacred? KALW's Angela Johnston brings us the story of the design of a sacred space in Marin County.
Architect Susie Colliver says experiencing the design of a sacred space begins way before you even step foot in a building.
So we're in the parking lot of Cultural Far.
That's a synagogue in Tiburon. We're surrounded by eucalyptus trees and grassy hills in the distance. The building is actually nowhere in sight. There's a twisting set of concrete stairs ahead of us. They wind around the trees, taking you 40 feet up the hill.
You leave the parking lot behind. You leave the everyday, you leave the secular behind. As you climb slowly, it's a very gentle rise of stairs.
We walk up the stairs. Colliver points out the concrete landings. They are imprinted with leaves from the trees above, and each landing has a bench.
It feels very doable. It feels very accessible. And psychologically, that's important, especially for people who are not as agile.
At the top, the synagogue finally comes into view. Its natural exterior blends into its surrounding. Colliver designed it 4 years ago. She's Jewish, but through her work designing low-income housing for religious groups, she's created sacred spaces for communities of all different faiths.
The hope is that from the parking lot, up the curved stairs, that one is going through a process of quieting.
This is what you might hear walking through the entryway on a Saturday morning.
We're going to start with Ma Tovu, the prayer that's said upon entering a place of prayer.
That's the congregation's Rabbi Chai Levi.
It says, "How good are your tents, Jacob?"
Along with music, light seeps through gaps in the walls of this curved hallway.
Not unlike being in a forest, the light is coming through slatted wood. So the light is hitting every piece of wood along the curved path a little differently.
That's because before Colliver even begins putting pen to paper, she asks a committee of community members a central question: to recall a place where they felt most connected to a spirit beyond themselves.
It's very rare that somebody will say a cathedral. It's far more likely in our experience that they'll say a sunset on the beach, or they'll say a mountaintop with an endless view, or they'll say a grove of trees with dappled light coming through.
You can feel this as you emerge into an open, round space, the sanctuary. It feels like the center of a redwood grove. The curved rows of seating are colored with a burnt red fabric, matching the bark of the trees nearby. They wrap around the central bima or pulpit.
People frequently let out a sigh. I think people feel a small sense of awe. And it's pretty palpable. You see it on faces a lot. You can hear it in people's breath.
Sitting in a service, you'd see Levy in the center, and also the faces of about 100 others.
When you're praying, you're seeing the face of the other, and that the divine dwells in that holy space where humans connect.
Levy says as soon as you put two people together, God is in the mix. It's something the rabbi and the committee wanted in Colliver's design.
I see both the beauty of people having prayerful experiences, and then also, you know, I see, honestly, the faces of people struggling with whatever they're going through in their lives.
Not only can people see one another clearly in the round, they can also see changes outside. Right above us is what Susie Colliver says is an important detail. There's a tradition in Judaism that the day starts not at midnight and not at daybreak, but actually when you can see the first three stars in the evening.
We gave them skylights through which you could discern when the new day had started by virtue of being able to see the stars. That was hugely important to them.
The design engages not just sight, but sound. Colliver says the congregation wanted to make sure everyone could hear each other.
We find that in many of the sacred spaces we're doing now, there is more emphasis put on participation than there is on sitting quietly and listening. The more important the room acoustics become, because it's less a single point of sound and more a communal experience.
That's true at Kol Shofar, where Rabbi Levy likes to lead interactive discussions. She also likes to lead the community in dancing, like at this recent children's service.
People holding hands and getting in a long line and dancing around. So, yeah, we were a community that wants to celebrate and feel joy together, and so having a space that people could dance in was definitely important.
So we're going to end with a prayer, with the words from the psalm that we sang earlier this morning.
When you look up to the ceiling from the bima, you'll notice a simple metal chandelier and a vaulted dome, which is offset from the center of the room. Colliver says this asymmetry is very intentional.
If it were symmetrical, there would be a suggestion that A, perfection is attainable, which we know it is not. We all have issues, we all have struggles, we all have conflict, and that conflict is made physical in this space. And people feel that very, very carefully.
Architect Susie Colliver says encouraging the search for meaning in the mundane is what spiritual architecture is all about. Whether it's the design of a synagogue, church, or a mosque. In Tiburon, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Mei Yamaoka spent the first years of her life in Lodi, California, born there to Japanese immigrant parents. In 1938, her dad decided to move the entire family back to his village outside Hiroshima. The idea was to help his kids connect to the Japanese language and culture. Then came war and everything changed. On August 6, 1945, the day the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, Japan, 16-year-old Mei and her younger sister, Mana, were at work. Mana was helping clear debris from demolished buildings in town. Mei worked in a cigarette factory at the city's edge.
It was a beautiful day, no clouds in the sky, blue sky, and the siren blared and said, air raid.
Mei survived the blast, returning to live in California several years later. She married a Japanese-American who'd been held in an internment camp here, and together they built a life. 3 children, 4 grandchildren, a home in El Cerrito. And for many years, she kept her stories of surviving the A-bomb to herself. But now, at the age of 87, she's sharing her experiences and fulfilling a promise she made to her dad back in Japan. And a note to the listeners, this piece deals with some disturbing content.
He told me that I want you to promise to get a diploma from the high school. I want you to graduate high school because education is very important. So I promised, okay, I told him that I will, which I did. And the other thing I promised him was that he wanted me to tell people about the horror of the war and how devastating the atomic bomb is, and that just tell people that, he says. So this is what I'm doing right now. It was 8 o'clock in the morning. It was a beautiful day, no clouds in the sky, blue sky, and the siren blared and said air raid. So we went into the shelter, and then 15 minutes later, all clear. So we went back to our station. And I was standing there, and all of a sudden, the bright light. Instantly, we knew what we had to do. We covered our eyes, our ears, nose, everything, and went on the floor. And when we went outside, we didn't know what was happening because nobody knew what it was. One of my classmates and I, we both had sisters in the same school. And we tried to get inside towards the city center, and we were stopped. We couldn't go in. And we saw all these people running. I mean, they were all, there are sceneries that I just can't explain what I saw. It was just horrid. It was just people burned with the skins hanging, and the blisters were huge, and I mean, no clothes. And that, I mean, it's something that I just did not want to relive. We started walking, and we walked home. It was a long walk. I was checking the distance, but I think it's something about where I live was about 20-something miles. Of course, my parents were so worried because they saw the cloud and the boom and the whatever, and waited for our sister to come home, and she never did. So my father and I, for the next 3 days, we searched for her. It was just so fortunate for us. She was gone, but they were piling up the dead corpse, and she was on top, the very top. And the reason we knew it was her is because she had an American made pink slip on with embroidery, and my dad said, "That's Mana." It's just so sad. I mean, I just can't think of her without crying. I'm sorry. I mean, she was so, bloated, and she had, I think, one side of the arm was almost severed. And anyway, when you think about it, we were lucky that we were able to give her a proper burial. My father had talked to the soldier and asked him to sit her aside, and he arranged for I think it might have been a truck or something to transport her home. So we had a regular service and burial. The other day somebody told me, you went through so much and you're up deep. And I said, if it helps to be negative, I will be, but it will pull everybody else down with me. And it's no use. I said, it doesn't help at all. It really doesn't help. There's a teaching that really helps me. It's called impermanence. And nothing stays the same. And my dad used to say, where there's life, there's death. Where there's shape or things, they break. And life is like the river that flows every day. It changes constantly. Shabonda matonda, yane made tonda, yane made tonde, koarete ki.
That was Hiroshima survivor Mei Yamaoka. The interview was produced by KELW's Julie Kane. Berkeley's annual Peace Lantern Ceremony commemorating victims of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki happens this Saturday. For more information, go to KELW.org, click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KELW's Julie Kane.
All week long, we've been playing you this sound. I swear. Think you know what that was and where we recorded it? To tell you more, we sent KALW's Hannah Kingsley Ma to Golden Gate Park.
Usually when Celia Hamilton plays the piano, she's at home in Port Orange, Florida. Today, though, she's playing Mozart's Rondo in the San Francisco Botanical Garden, underneath the sloping, gnarled branches of a New Zealand Christmas tree. Celia is 12 years old. She's visiting San Francisco for the first time, outfitted in a requisite summer sweatshirt, and here with her mom, Liesl. They found this piano on a total whim.
Well, we were driving somewhere else, and I saw the sign, and I said, let me find parking. We have to do this. It wasn't on our schedule at all, but I just thought it would be amazing for her.
The sign she's talking about was a banner advertising Flower Piano, a 12-day installation in July where a dozen pianos were scattered throughout the botanical garden. Celia tells me playing outside just sounds a lot different than being indoors.
It's like kind of echoey inside since there's like walls, like the sound is bouncing off, but the outside is just like going in different directions all over the place.
Here, flowers hang down from the trees. It's shaded and cool. Celia tells me she likes how it feels all swampy, and I ask her if it's hard to compete with the sound of a nearby sprinkler.
Well, it's kind of like a metronome, since it's like on beat sometimes.
There are a lot of crazy sounds happening around us, and through the magic of installation art, they all suddenly seem to be imbued with a kind of musical quality. There are lawnmowers and little ones going berserk, and the gentle yet firm controlling of parents trying to get their kids to play.
Doesn't have to be the whole thing, right?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be the whole thing.
That's how I meet Madison Toro. She's 14, has been studying piano for about 4 years, and her mom really wants her to play something, just a little something. Madison serenades us with Bach and then leaps forward a couple hundred years to Adele. Out of the corner of my eye, I notice a woman on a nearby bench listening intently. Her earrings are the shape of tiny electric guitars, and she's tied a scarf patterned with musical notes around her straw hat. She looks like a true devotee. So, I do what any good radio reporter would do and creepily follow her to the Mesoamerican cloud forest to try and get her to talk to me.
My name is Nancy Lindemann. I'm from San Carlos, California.
Nancy is really into flower piano. She loves playing outside, especially at the piano tucked within a redwood grove.
I came Friday for the first time. I came back Saturday, and now I'm here today. Because I was here so long that my car got towed.
Nancy's shy. Usually she plays the piano at home, after dinner, by herself. She's so shy that she won't play for me, wary of my recorder. But she does like the spontaneity that comes along with an unexpected audience.
I was playing all by myself, and a man came up behind me and just started singing the song, and then he asked me to play it again.
What was the song?
I Can't Stop Loving You, the Ray Charles song. Oh, it's exciting.
There is an excitement about the place. On my way out of the gardens, I run into two older ladies from Petaluma on a garden club field trip, Nina Komiakoff and Susan Price. One is playing the piano, the other is dancing about, and both are in stitches.
Were they originally Dolly's sisters?
How long have you guys been friends for?
About an hour and a half.
I don't believe that you guys have only met an hour ago.
We did.
We did,
yeah.
We're very silly. That's because you don't think that we're invisible at this age.
Dancing comes naturally to Susan.
I used to be a dancer.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
You see?
When I was young and very beautiful.
And Nina has been playing piano for 70 years.
How long have you been playing?
Since I was seven. I'm a Juilliard dropout.
Oh, wow.
Got even with my father. Dropped it out.
She tells me playing outdoors makes her feel part of the setting. She launches into Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata.
Wait.
While Nina plays, Susan turns the pages of dog-eared, yellowing sheet music. They laugh and talk throughout the piece with the ease of old friends. They came here to see the flora and the fauna of the gardens, but most likely it's the music they'll remember. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Kingsley-Ma.
Our winner this week made audiograph history. He is 3 years old, which makes him the youngest audiograph winner ever. His name is Moby Gordon, and he spent 2 days hanging out at Flower Piano with his family. Congratulations, Moby! We're going to send you a very small KALW t-shirt. For the rest of you, here's a sneak listen to next week's mystery sound.
Almost there. Got it.
There's actually dog paws down there too, so when we have our dog running, we make her touch those dog paws.
Think you know what that is and where we recorded it? Give us a call and tell us. 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We love hearing from you, especially the little ones. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
Thanks, Julie. And if you have other mysterious sounds you think would make a great audiograph, give us a call and tell us about them. The number is 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. And that's all for us today. Our team includes Bonnie Chan, Jürgen Klemm, Lucy Kang, Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Justine Lee, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, James Rowlands, Raja Shah, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Andrew Stelzer. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And this music is by San Francisco's own Kronos Quartet, and you can hear them live tonight at KALW's 75th anniversary party. It's at the Norse Theater in San Francisco, starts at 8 o'clock, and tickets are available at the door. We'll be there, so come celebrate with us. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.